We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 142.
On today's show, we conclude our pre-Clovis discussion with four of the oldest human occupation sites in the Americas.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everybody. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Well, we are still in Austin, Texas, and we are in the middle. I know nobody here cares. Nobody on this podcast probably cares. But nobody. there's secret fans out there that just kind of come out of the woodwork.
I know. You never know who's a fan.
I know. But we're in the middle of our Formula One weekend here in Austin. We had our first day yesterday. Immediately when we're done recording here, we're going to go to the next day, which has practice and qualifying and a bunch of other events.
What? We're not recording the day before this podcast comes out.
Hey, be quiet.
Hey.
I know. This is current information. So anyway, culturally, it's a very interesting event. We're not going to spend time talking about it, but culturally, it's a very interesting event. You see all different types. It's very different from NASCAR, which I've been to a couple NASCAR events. We both have.
Yeah.
It's a different deal.
It's very different. And there's a lot of people flying in from different places. A lot of Mexican people, because it's pretty easy to pop up here from Mexico, I think. So,
And Sergio Perez is a very, very popular Mexican driver.
Very popular. Yeah.
So he's good, and he's in one of the top teams, and he's well liked down there. So, all right. Well, that being said,
that's it. That's all we'll say about Formula One, but we're here and we're loving it. So
I know. I wish we could do something there and like record there or something. But yeah.
For what podcast?
Yeah. I have no idea. A podcast that doesn't exist. Yeah. So we're going to continue part two of our pre-Clovis sites series. And we got a few sites. We started a little bit earlier a little bit later in time, I should say, closer to us. And now we're going to move further back in time.
Right.
For pre-Clovis sites.
Yeah. Because the further back in time you go, the less accepted and well-established those sites are as actually being pre-Clovis.
Yeah.
So we figured we would move back in time, and also at the same time, we're also moving back in acceptedness. That's a word, right? Sure. That works. You know.
All right. So this next one is called Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, and it's in Washington County, Pennsylvania. This was discovered by a farmer in 1955. He found a stone tool in like a groundhog hole. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, this guy, Albert Miller, he just decided to, you know, hey, an archaeologist should probably see this, which is a really neat thing for him to think in 1955. And so he started looking around, and I don't know what the process was for that, but it was nearly 20 years later that he connected with Dr. James Ottavasio at the University of Pittsburgh. And Ottavasio's name has become synonymous with Meadowcroft since then. So anybody who is in archaeology and took like a 101 class has heard the name Ottavasio because Meadowcroft is discussed in that class.
Right.
Now,
20 years? Really? So he just like sat on it for 20 years? Like, oh yeah, this is a thing.
Well, he either sat on it or people didn't take him seriously and didn't come out and look at it.
Sure, that's possible.
So, you know, that's always the thing. So Ottavasio looked at it, and he brought out a field school to do some excavation there. And over the next 6 years, the field school found almost 2 million artifacts and ecofacts. We'll talk about that, including tools, fire pits, and pottery.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Ecofacts are basically things that were transported in by humans, like, I don't know, I would guess different rock material, stuff like that. It can also be shapes of things. I don't exactly know what the ecofacts were, but it could be things in the shape of, like, naturally in the shape of something that, you know, looks like something people would have used. Yeah, ecofacts can be almost anything.
It's basically something that we think people used for some reason,
right?
But they might not have necessarily modified it in a way that's identifiable, right?
Yeah. So where this thing fits in history is the radiocarbon testing put this at Well, there's a rock ledge overhang that served as a campsite for here, and it's been heavily excavated. I mean, way deep, excavated down way deep, like a lot of rock shelters can be. And they dated this thing to up to 19,000 years ago. Mm. And as we've been learning, anything pre-Clovis is going to have some sort of criticism to it, of course, because people are doubtful of, you know, what it is. And the criticism here focuses on, of course, the radiocarbon dates. It's very easy to criticize radiocarbon dates. When you get it right, well, let me just put it this way. It's physics. So when the mass spectrometer says this radiocarbon you told me about is this old, it's not wrong.
Right.
But the problem comes in with, well, how did that radiocarbon get there? What did the radiocarbon do throughout its life cycle? What is it contaminated? Was other stuff on it? Was it ever exposed? And then, you know, something else. Anyway, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with the actual carbon. And that's one of the major criticisms here is they think it could have been, some people think it could have been contaminated by ancient carbon from coal bearing strata in the watershed.
Right.
So just like leaking through the area and into the carbon. So those are some of the major criticisms of Meadowcroft. But then, of course, you can always find somebody that will say, nope, this isn't really true. A third party geomorphologist came in and said it doesn't look like groundwater activity has contributed to contamination. So there isn't a lot of flow of groundwater through this area, at least from the coal to the site, apparently.
I mean, I still have a little skepticism there because, like, one expert... You can always find one expert who'll say the thing that you want them to say.
No,
like nothing against this guy. Maybe he's totally genuine, but it just seems like you're saying, as with all of these really old sites, they only have one source of dating, and then you just need multiple to really confirm that this 19,000-year-old date is accurate.
Where this also tends to go off the rails for some archaeologists is in the stone tool collection that they found there. There's something they're calling the Miller Complex because of Albert Miller, probably, and a point was found there. It's a lancelet projectile point, thin and unfluted. So lancelet, which just means long and thin.
Yeah.
And it's like, think of it like a spear point. There's no flute on it like you find with Clovis points. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, this point, this tool complex or tradition was, I guess, first identified here, but they found other tools that are very similar to this complex in other parts of Pennsylvania and all the way down to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been other tools like this found. Now, here's where it kind of goes a little crazy is you often have an artifact assemblage or something like that, and that's usually undisputed. It is what it is. You can see it. You can make your own interpretation. But the interpretation is what usually gets people into trouble and brings the entire site into question. And Ottavasio has said that this complex has Eurasiatic and Siberian appearances to its tools. So he was making the connection that, hey, maybe people did come over here from Europe and through Siberia and took this stone tool tradition with them. And that's not implausible, I guess, but it just wasn't one of the standing theories of the time when he started making these claims. And so, you know, people started to, I guess, dismiss Meadowcroft a little bit because once you start associating it with something that people think is not true, then it becomes to bring the whole thing into question, you know?
Well, I think for me, when I look at an argument like that, I'm like, okay, you can take these stone tools, these projectile points, and be like, okay, they look like this tradition here and this tradition here and this tradition here.
Yeah.
You could definitely make those comparisons. But for me, I feel like you have to stop there because you can't say, without any other evidence, any other anything, saying that it definitely came, it's a ancestor, or it came before or after or whatever. Somehow it's in the same lineage as the other traditions. You just can't say that without any other evidence to back that up.
All right, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on Meadowcroft. We wanted to mention it. It's a very famous site here in the United States. And we're going to move now to what's becoming another very famous site in the United States, which is kind of what prompted this entire series of podcasts and a few other shows on the APN, the footprints in White Sands, New Mexico.
Yeah, this definitely prompted this whole conversation because I realized I didn't have a lot of knowledge about other pre-Clovis sites except for you know, the big famous ones. And I just wanted to like deep dive them a little bit more. So that, yeah, that was part of it. And also the sites that we've talked about, obviously Metalcroft and then some of the ones from last week, they're not super well accepted in the community, but this White Sands one, I feel like it's gonna have, like, as, yeah, more and more comes out about it, I think that people are going to have to accept that there were people here 21,000 to 23,000 years ago.
Yeah, and they left their footprints too, so yeah, that's, yeah, that's what it is. It's actually, just to describe it a little bit, if you look at it, it was footprints at the edge of a lake that's no longer there. It's now just sandy desert. Mm-hmm. And anybody's seen when you put your footprints into sand that it will leave your footprints there, right? So there would have been lots of footprints here, more than likely, and not all of them would have solidified, so to speak, and preserved. But what more than likely happened here, if you just think about it, is this lake may have been either on its way out or seasonally it was drying up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it's got a, you know, anybody who's familiar with any sort of desert environment knows that lakes can come and go in a season, but mm-hmm, with a rain pretty quick.
Yep.
And who knows how long this lake was here. I'm sure the scientists know, but I don't. But they were on the lake edge, and it was probably drying, and then left footprints. The lake dried away, and the footprints just dried super fast. And then through whatever processes, they were covered again, and by dust and sand or whatever happened. But it was a perfect storm of circumstances, probably literally a perfect storm of circumstances to cover these footprints. And then eventually they basically hardened with the rock around them, and we were able to extract the strata that was above them and reveal footprints.
Yeah.
So,
and you shouldn't think that it's only human footprints that are there, sure, either. There's footprints from all kinds of different animals. And they've been finding preserved footprints there since the 1930s, and it includes things like extinct megafauna, like the giant sloth, which I thought was, yeah, was really cool. I didn't even know giant sloths exist, and to know that they were roaming the earth back then is just like, yeah, a little bit terrifying, but really cool.
Yeah. So along with the paper that was written, they discussed 5 track horizons that contain human footprints, with track 1 being the oldest and track 5 being the youngest. And you can take a look at the paper and some of the resources that we have here. There's a pretty good plan view map of what was found.
Yeah, it's in the Nat Geo article in particular, mm-hmm, which Nat Geo kind of annoys me because you only get to read like 3 free articles a month or whatever. I'm like almost ready to just give them my money so that I can read them anytime I want, because, yeah, they do the best job with the articles. Yeah. But anyway, the plan view map in that article is really, really cool. So you should take a look at it.
Yeah, indeed. So how these were dated, these are all kind of on top of each other, and you can't date fossilized footprints.
Right.
There's nothing there, right? We were talking about on the Archaeotech podcast, I was wondering if any sort of skin cells or anything were potentially there that
like
could be discovered.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an easy thing to find. I doubt it. I really doubt it.
Yeah.
And it probably was washed away or something like that over
time.
Like,
all the naysayers are going to throw contamination up. So,
well, but if you can pull cells up, you can do a DNA analysis, yeah, and you'll be able to genetically clock that back too.
That's true.
At least that time period.
That
so
would be cool.
Anyway, how they did date it was basically with what's again called relative dating, which you typically have to use if you don't have any sort of carbon source or any other source, or it's too old, right? This, mm-hmm, isn't too old for radiocarbon dating, but there's no datable radiocarbon stuff directly associated with it. Directly human, I guess.
Yeah.
Created.
Like human-made carbon. Yeah.
But they did use radiocarbon dating, and they used it on these seeds of a plant that grows along this river and, along this lake and in the lake. And, mm-hmm, these seeds are all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And they're even in the footprints, crushed by people. So clearly, you know, sitting in the footprints, but then they're all over the place in this little area. So what they were able to do was basically date the layers above, in, and below the footprints, because it's very stratigraphically sound, mm-hmm, as something along a lake edge would be. They're very, very linear.
Yeah.
And that was pretty, pretty easy to date. And they dated those, and they got lots and lots and lots of dates that correlated their findings. And that's how they dated this to 21 to 23,000 years ago. And it was pretty clear.
Yeah. I don't think anybody is throwing up red flags about the dating at all. There's one question that comes into play with the dating is, it's something called reservoir effect with dating. And I think you and Paul talked a lot about that. So why don't you explain what that is?
Yeah. So reservoir effect is essentially something you already know about, but probably don't realize it. We often talk about having to store carbon in our atmosphere and other places. Like, what's a good carbon sink in this world? And we're always concerned about that because of the greenhouse effect, and mm-hmm. we're producing so much CO2. Where can the world naturally store all this carbon? One of the places they store carbon is in plants. Plants take in CO2 and they store carbon, but also seas. So mm-hmm. so big forests are big carbon sinks. If you cut down the rainforest, you lose a big place where we can store carbon.
Right.
But also water. Water naturally, and all the things in water, just stores carbon from the atmosphere. And because of that, plants that grow in the water also have a heightened level of carbon in them from that effect.
Wow.
They're more of a reservoir for the carbon,
right,
so to speak, and it they can just hold more than the things around them. So
gotcha.
One of the instant criticisms of this were, well, these of course had more carbon in them and therefore were older, because all you're doing is counting what's there,
mm-hmm.
and therefore were older, and that's why there's more. But the reservoir effect was taken into account here. They,
yeah.
they adjusted for that, and I'm willing to bet they adjusted conservatively, which tells me that this could be even older
yeah.
than they're saying, but they're being conservative with their estimates
mm-hmm.
on the effect of the reservoir effect at that time. So
yeah, I think I read that somebody said that even if there's a bigger effect than they originally thought, it still wouldn't change the date by more than like 1,000 years or so.
Yeah, still pretty old.
Yeah, so that's still like really, really old and way before yeah. everything else. So that's the skepticism with the dating. And I think that can be mostly dismissed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty well shown that these dates are pretty solid. So here's the other skepticism. And we've talked to some archaeologists who feel this way. We won't say who. But the skeptics wonder if these prints are actually human footprints. That's the skepticism.
Yeah. And the Life and Ruins crew had some Paleo-Indian experts on talking about this. And they were the people that were wondering that were wondering if, because they said that all the footprints from the humans were from like juveniles and adolescents, which totally makes sense. The parents are up on shore, like doing stuff and living, and the kids mm-hmm. are playing near the water. Right. So there might be an over exaggerated sample of smaller footprints.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. it's a snapshot in time. You're getting
yeah.
one snapshot, and it happens to
right.
be when children were playing on a lakeshore.
Right.
So you have to accept that.
But they're also slightly deformed and rounded and stuff like that, as footprints in sand would be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they slump, all kinds of things happen. So they're not like clearly defined footprints. I mean, they are pretty clear. But somebody
yeah.
was wondering, somebody, I guess it was commented, is it like baby sloth footprints?
And, oh, yeah.
And Life and Ruins guys, they actually looked it up while they were on the podcast, and they're like, no, that's actually very different. So,
yeah.
I mean, when you look at other stuff that was around at the time, they're definitely human footprints.
Because they're definitely footprints. Nobody is debating
yeah,
that.
They're
sure. definitely footprints. The question is whether or not they're human. And I think that that's something that the experts did, is they looked at all the things that it could be from this area, and it's none of those. So it really must be human. So that,
yeah.
I don't know. For me, I'm willing to accept that. Other
yeah.
skeptics aren't. But I think that no matter what, this is really cool. And hopefully we get even more data from this site that'll keep confirming these dates that we...
Right.
These older dates that we have to accept.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that a little more as we wrap up this little series here in segment 3. But for now, let's move on to a big old cave down in Mexico. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode 142 of the Archaeology Show. And we are going to move south to Chicuiuti Cave in Mexico. I hope I'm saying that right. I'm bringing in some of my Spanish school knowledge to get those letters sounding correctly, but I think that's how you say it.
I am on day 162 of learning Spanish through Duolingo, and I actually have no idea, but it looks good.
Well, no, you're doing pretty good. It's just, yeah. The letters are just, well, here, I'll spell it. C-H-I-Q-U-I-H-U-I-T-E.
I think that's right.
So Chicuiuti is how I'm going to say that. Now, this is a really cool cave in Mexico, and it was excavated by Ciprian Ardalan of Autonomous University of Zacatecas. I know, Ciprian Ardalan, that's like the coolest archaeology name ever.
Like
he needs like an Indiana Jones style movie about him. Anyway, and he looks like the coolest archaeologist ever too in the pictures. Go check out the articles that we link to. So Chicuiuti Cave is located in the Mexican state of Zacatecas, which is in north central Mexico. It is a high altitude cave at 2,740 meters above sea level, which is approximately 8,990 feet.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. It is very, very high. And it is not accessible. It's like, how did they even find it? I guess the local people, the native people probably knew about it forever and ever. But the current access to the cave is a 4 to 5 mile uphill rock scramble over boulders. Sounds pretty miserable, and some of the pictures make it look pretty terrible. So it is quite the trek to get to it.
This says north central Mexico.
Yeah.
I never really looked that up. I mean, is that something we could like go visit from New Mexico or something? I don't know where that would be. New Mexico or Arizona? Where's north central?
It's probably over Texas. It's probably, yeah. It's almost maybe directly south of where we are right now, actually, because Mexico swings way to the east, you know, after.
Maybe closer to El Paso.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is that they talked about the conditions at the site a little bit in the article that I read. And like, it's not just a 4 to 5 uphill rock scramble to get to the site. It's also like a days long donkey train to get to the camp before they get to the site, you know? So it is very remote and not super accessible unless you are planning on staying there for weeks on end.
We, just as a side note, might be taking a donkey train to some Baja California rock art through the California Rock Art Foundation.
Yeah.
Check out CRAF. It's carockart.org, I believe, is the website.
Yeah.
Check out
donkey trains to get to archaeology sites. I don't know.
I want to take a donkey train.
I don't know about all that, but anyway.
I still want to do that. Because forget about a 4 to 5 hour uphill rock scramble. As archaeologists, we've done those, and I don't want a 4 to 5 minute uphill rock scramble. No. Like, that is excruciating.
The field school I did in Peru was like a 15 minute uphill rock scramble, and like, it killed me every day.
Yeah. It's like sand, but sharp rocks.
Yeah. And the one in Peru, you know, we were like stepping on human bone as we went too, because it also happened to be, you know, their burial area. But, yeah, you know, anyway, Peru is a different place. So, okay, so back to this cave. It might have been a much more inviting area in the past because the entrance that they're accessing in this 4 to 5 mile up or 4 to 5 hour uphill scramble is kind of like a side or a back entrance or something.
Yeah.
There used to be a front entrance that was right near a spring-fed creek, and that has since been blocked by rock slides. But I think most of the excavations they're doing is closer to that end of the cave near where the water access was. Mm-hmm. So this cave is well stratified, and it has established dates for each layer through both radiocarbon and luminescence dating. So they do have two forms of dating going on here,
that's
which is
good.
Yeah, really great. So like, the dates are pretty indisputable. And they recovered nearly 2,000 lithic artifacts of different types, flakes and bifaces and projectile points and all that kind of stuff. And they're at a depth of about 3 to 3.5 meters below the cave surface. They all do seem to be contained in a older strata, right? So it's all pretty deep. And they were able to date the organic material associated with that using the different dating methods I just mentioned. And that puts the layers that the artifacts were found in at 12,000 to 32,000 years old.
That's crazy.
I know. Yeah. 32,000. What?
You know, something about caves real quick. I'm having trouble visualizing what cave life would have been like at the earliest times, right? Because you look at, say, Meadowcroft, you look at Chicxulub, you look at Gay Cliff Shelter in Nevada. Gay Cliff Shelter in Nevada is a well-known, very prominent, dug by David Hirst Thomas, and, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, and I think there might even still be stuff going on there today randomly. But mm-hmm. they went down like meters.
Yeah.
And it's like, how was this even accessible back mm-hmm. in that time period? Now, true, the entrances to some of these caves would also have been lower stratigraphically, but I just don't understand how, when you start going down as far as like even these guys went down 3 to 3.5 meters, what did that look like as the approach to the cave when it was 12 feet lower than it yeah. is now, or 9 to 12 feet lower than it is now?
Yeah.
What does that even... How do you get in there? Why do you get in there?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just...
The geology of it is super yeah. crazy when you start thinking about it like that. Because, yeah, the only reason there's artifacts 3 to 3.5 meters below the surface is because that's where the surface was, you know, that yeah. that long ago. So,
but caves build up a lot quicker than the surrounding area does.
They do.
Because things flow in there. There's always water seepage into the cave. So the surface will build up faster than the surrounding area typically, which means... If you go back further in time, it's getting deeper quicker than the surrounding area.
Right.
If you were to look at it as like a time lapse. But I don't know. That's one of my favorite things to do, is to kind of visualize whatever site we're on. What did this actually look like back in the day? Because it didn't look like what you're sitting on now right. in most cases. Unless
yeah.
it was only a few hundred years ago. Even if it was 1,000 years ago, the vegetation was probably a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because... things change in the atmosphere, you
yeah.
know, for temperatures and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. And like, they do have some pictures of the actual excavation in the article.
Yeah.
I think it's Nat Geo again. Those guys are just killing it with their articles.
Which is hard to read, frustratingly, because you got to put in all your information
yeah,
if you read too many articles.
Yeah,
and I mean,
yeah,
I understand
yeah.
they want to make money, blah,
I know,
blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah. Maybe we should just give them some money so that we can read all we want. I just said that last segment, and I just said it again. So maybe,
yeah.
anyway.
Probably should.
Anyway,
donate to the Archaeology Podcast Network so we can afford our Nat Geo subscription.
I know, right?
Archpodnet.com/members.
So anyway, so the team were able to, like I said, use both OSL and carbon dating to date the artifacts, OSL being...
optically stimulated luminescence.
Yes, that.
That's going to be the name of my punk rock band.
Yes. And they came to the conclusion that the artifacts were deposited starting 26,000 years ago. So they did have some of those older dates that went into 30,000 years ago, but based on where they found things, where their dates were, they kind of went a little bit more conservative and said 26,000
yeah.
years ago. And like 26,000 is not conservative. That is way beyond even, I mean, that's another 5,000 years beyond what they're saying about the footprints, right?
Yeah, but...
Or 3,000 years beyond.
But this is, you know, 1,000 miles away from the footprints. Maybe not 1,000, but it's farther away.
It is, yeah.
Which came first? How did people go? What were the paths?
Yeah.
Those are all the big questions, right?
How did that
right?
even happen? Yeah.
Yeah. So what's wrong with this?
Okay. There are some things wrong with this. First of all, there is no proof that the organic material that was dated, the radiocarbon dates, is human-derived.
Mm-hmm.
It could be from natural fires burning around and blowing in. It's from the desert. It, you know, there's fires all the time and things could have blown in. There's no carbon that can be specifically related to humans, no hearts, no features. And also the bones, because they had some burnt bone, there's no cut marks on any of the bones found either. There's just nothing showing that humans affected any of the carbon that was dated. Okay, fine.
That's no cut marks on the bones is kind of a big deal, because even
yeah.
if you didn't process the meat and you just threw something onto the fire, I mean, people were hungry back then.
Yeah.
When I eat a chicken wing now, I mean, I'm usually pretty hungry when I'm doing it. And uh-huh. I probably leave little drag marks with my teeth on the chicken wing. That's not even like a joke. That just happens, right? You're eating a steak, you're eating a bone, you're going to clean that thing off and you're probably going to leave some marks. Now, there's ethnographic evidence throughout many civilizations on the planet that they also would, especially after they're cooked, like crack these bones open and suck the marrow out. And that you would have to either chew or smash or something like that. And I feel like there would just be something.
Yeah.
From, you know, the U-shaped grooves from teeth on yeah. some of these bones. Now it's possible it was all burned away.
It's possible. It's possible. I think they tested about 50 different items for, they did carbon dating on about 50 different items. And I'm just not sure how good the samples were as yeah. far as knowing what the item was originally.
Yeah.
So anyway, the whole site, it's like one of the biggest problems with the whole site is that it consists entirely of stone artifacts. Mm-hmm. There's no other evidence of a human occupation. None of the other things that you might expect to see in a place where people are living, you know, yeah. they're living there and there's just nothing else. Now, we've talked about this before on this podcast. There's the missing majority, right? Because the things that decompose away,
yeah.
you just don't have them anymore. Especially and you can't the have them. Exactly. So, like, it could just be a stone artifact site, and that is what it is. But then we get to the next big problem. And the next big problem, which I get it. I looked at the pictures and I get it. The stone artifacts themselves are questionable as to whether they were human-made or naturally formed in a creek or water environment yeah. that is active and constantly breaking and fracturing rocks.
Right.
So you guys should definitely go look at our show notes links because the article, I don't believe you can read the actual article itself. However, you can look at all the figures. That's one of the great parts about these articles that are behind paywalls is usually you can read the abstract and you can see all the figures. And so you can go look at the pictures of, and they've got these compilation photos that's just like a whole bunch of artifacts piled in mm-hmm. together. And you can see that they look kind of like artifacts, but they're also kind of not, you know, like you yeah. can see how they were naturally derived as well.
Well, and didn't they say that the material that these were made out of was a limestone that is not natural to this cave?
They did. That's what they're saying.
That's kind of a big smoking gun. Like, yeah. how did that get there?
Yeah, that's you know? True. It's debated whether or not it's natural to the cave. The researchers are saying that it's not natural to the cave, and there's skepticism around that mm-hmm. argument from the rest of the archaeology community. The material itself, I looked at the pictures and it looks pretty low quality. And when you have a low quality stone like that, it makes the artifacts not look as pretty, and they mm-hmm. don't look as smooth. They don't look as well made. They don't make tools that are as well made. They, you yeah. know, like when it's lower quality, it just doesn't look as good, but that doesn't mean that they're not human made. They yeah. they could still be, you know? So I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it. I think that probably in the context of the excavation, when you find something that they're calling a stone tool compared with the other stones that are there naturally, they mm-hmm. it probably was a pretty distinct difference. And that's why they're so into it being a new stone tool assemblage that we haven't seen before.
Right.
And it is a new stone tool assemblage because it looks nothing like anything else in the area, anything else from this time period. Not that we have any other dates going back 26,000 years, but nothing, right. nothing else from the pre-Clovis time period. And that is interesting. But here's one more piece of skepticism that researchers bring in about these stone tools. Is that you have a 10,000 year occupation time period, right? Because they dated mm-hmm. this from 12,000 to 32,000 years ago, with the oldest being, they're really starting it conservatively at 26,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So a roughly 10,000 year occupation. There is zero evolution in those stone tools. Now, when you talk about 10,000 years of occupation, when you push that time period forward, you get so much evolution. You see so mm-hmm. many different tool types showing up. So, like, where is the evolution in the lithic tool assemblage over 10,000 years?
I mean, there's precedent for this because when you look at, say, tools at 2 million years old, it's nothing to say there was no tool evolution for 1.5 million years.
Right.
It's literally nothing to say that.
Right.
And that's common to assume that, right? You go back that far in time, the tool evolution is slower because, well, cognitively, people weren't, you know, doing stuff. But also, evolutionarily, as far as technology goes, technology is driven, just like it is today, by need. And if you didn't need to develop different stone tools to do things, then that's what you would do. There was a explosion in stone tools for many reasons in, you know, in the United States and, like, I guess North America post the last glacial maximum and when the glaciers started to end, primarily because the big thing that they were taking down for most of their food started to die out. So they had to start hunting smaller and smaller game, which these smaller points, the dart points and the eventually way later when bow and arrow was invented, those points as well. And even atlatl points were smaller than like long spear points. That technology started to grow, and you also had more and more people. There was, more and more people around as you went through time. There was just more groups, and that alone is going to cause different ideas in how to do things. And so when you get more people and you get a technological reason to evolve your stone tool shapes, then that's going to happen. But if for 10,000 years life was great and you had plenty of food
and you didn't need to,
what do you need to do anything different for?
Yeah, I totally get that. So that's why I made that the third point of skepticism, because it doesn't feel quite as skeptical to me as some of the other reasons.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to think about, though, because these are still modern humans.
Yeah.
Brain capacity wise and the way they think and act, they're not that different from humans.
Oh, they're exactly the same.
10,000 or 15,000 years later. So, so they're the same. So they had the same ability to evolve and change and be creative, really, with it. But you're right. If they didn't need to, then they might not have committed the brain power to doing that. So
there you go.
Anyway, yeah, it's really interesting.
Well, there's a lot more. There's actually a number of other sites that we could have brought into this that date to older than this. But we are, for the end of this series, going to jump all the way back to 130,000 years ago in San Diego. So, which, as we all know, stands for... No, it doesn't. All right. It's not German for anything. All right, back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the final segment of episode 142 of the Archaeology Show. Our pre-Clovis site series is coming to an end.
Yeah.
And it's coming to an end with the oldest site that is proposed to be human created in North America, in all the Americas.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing that is thought to be older than this. And there's definitely some skepticism and some issues around it. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. And I included this one, obviously, because it's the oldest. And I looked at all of the other pre-Clovis sites, and the site that we talked about in the last segment, the Chicxulub Cave, seemed to be the oldest site that was still like a pretty good potential pre-Clovis site. But there's kind of nothing between then and Cerruti.
Yeah.
There's an occasional one like Topper, which we talked about in segment one. They've got a date that is 50,000 years old, which is really, really, people are really skeptical of that.
Yeah.
But there's not a whole lot of other sites that there's good dating and good artifacts coming out of. So here we are 100,000 years in the past at Cerruti. So what is it and why is it so old?
Right. So we're going to speak in some general terms here. There's a lot published about this because it really came out about, I don't know, 4 years ago or so.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years ago. And I actually have a bunch of links in the show notes. As a little bit of a side note, we've got over 3,000 episodes on the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you go to arcpodnet.com, and you just go to the main page there and scroll down a little ways, there's a search field that will search all the podcasts and it will search the titles and show notes and tags and everything that's in there. So check that out because there's a lot of good stuff in there. And I actually pulled out a number of podcasts as not sources, but just other things, other shows talking about it. And I actually, just within a few weeks of this, the primary paper for this coming out, I interviewed one of the authors, Stephen Holland. We'll talk about what he said here in a minute here, but you should really go check that podcast out because it was pretty good. I like that interview. But basically, Cerruti, I don't even know where the name came from, but it's basically downtown like San Diego. And they were doing a road project back in the early 90s, I want to say, and found some bones. Like while they were digging up. Now, I don't know how long they've been doing this, but California, especially Southern California, has a lot of paleontology just because of how the geology is. And they often, when you see an archaeological monitor out there, you may see three monitors on a California project, an archaeological monitor, a Native American monitor, mm-hmm. and a paleontological monitor.
Right.
And sometimes a biological monitor. Yep. So you got a whole bunch of people standing around just watching the hole get dug and looking for stuff. So they put a stop on it. They collected a bunch of stuff, mapped it all out. And then since this was a road project, basically just pushed on, and now it's buried under a highway, wherever it is. So
right.
all this stuff was put into a museum, and I guess it was looked at a little bit, but never really fully analyzed or discussed until Stephen Holland and his colleagues got a hold of it decades later.
Mm-hmm.
They started looking at it and said, wait a minute, these are like mastodon bones with cut marks, and there's these rocks that are associated with them that don't look like super great stone tools, but they look like primitive stone tools where just a few flakes are taken off of them. Again, I'll go back to like Oldowan tools, which are some of the oldest tools on the planet that mm-hmm. we can identify as tools. And they're just like cobbles with a couple, you know, it's like you bang the cobbles together and you can take a couple flakes off and make some sort of an edge.
Right.
And do that. So that's the kind of stuff that was found. Well, his whole team was skeptical. They're like, wait a minute, we've dated this thing. And they used some other radiometric dating to date this site, but they dated the stuff around it. Again, you can't date these artifacts themselves, but they dated relatively the stuff around it to about 130,000 years.
And those dates are good, right?
The dates
are
decent. Yeah.
They're
yeah.
not.
The dates are not the point of contention here,
yeah.
right? The dates are good. They look great. Mm-hmm. Fine. Dates are good. Well, they took these what they were calling stone tools and sent them off to experts in that kind of a stone tool and said, what do these look like to you? And they said, oh yeah, they look like tools, anything you'd find in, you know, Africa, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. Where'd you find these? And they're like, San Diego. They're like, that's not possible. What are you talking about? So the criticisms around this, of course, are that these tools, so to speak, could have been created by natural processes.
Right.
And they also could have been created by the bulldozers. There's people that think that the actual road construction actually made these tools, which we've seen before.
Yeah.
You know, you see a bulldozer scrape and you can definitely see some like recent flakes taken off.
Yeah.
And that rock that the bulldozer crushed over with this flake taken off of it, like maybe even a big flake or something like that, is probably going to look like that unaltered without any changes to it for thousands of years.
Right.
They just don't weather a right. lot of rocks.
Right.
You know, they don't, unless they're in constant water, they don't smooth out. They don't really weather. If it's in a really dry environment, it's going to look like that for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So even 130,000 years, I mean, yeah. you know, whatever, but the biggest concerns are, did humans create the cut marks? Or were they other animals or something like that? And because it's definitely mastodon bones. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah.
But did humans create the cut marks? And also, did humans create these tools?
Yeah.
The rocks were found in what was called a high energy environment back in the day, geologically speaking. I don't think it is now, but it would have been like a river outlet.
Right, right.
And that's always a high energy environment, moves rocks around.
And breaks them.
Breaks them.
Yeah.
I mean, take a look the next time you're bopping around a river. I don't know if you're anywhere in like the eastern United States, this probably isn't a thing unless you're up north because it's all like sandy. But I grew up in the Pacific Northwest where all of our rivers were covered by rocks.
Yeah.
Like you had to wear shoes in the river
yeah.
because it was just rocks. And to be honest, after reading this and talking about it again, I want to go to one of those environments and see if find the naturally
natural
created tools
yeah.
and see what
yeah.
these rocks look like. I've yeah. seen rocks moving in like a fast moving eddy
yeah.
and you get the smaller rocks and it's just, it's crazy.
Yeah. They hit just right
yeah.
and they break. And then if they hit just right again, they break again. They
right.
could make an edge that looks like something
right.
a human could use. But here's the other thing too, is like humans could have been taking advantage of the natural environment.
Oh, sure.
If like, let's just set aside the fact that everybody's very skeptical of the mm-hmm. fact that this is an actual human site. But if there were humans there, and this is a very active environment, and it's creating sharp rocks all the time because of the way it naturally moves, then they might have just been picking those rocks up and using them because they're already there. They're already sharp. And why put the effort into making them into a tool if it's already doing it for you, you know?
Right, right. I mean, expedient tools, whether you made them or not, are definitely a thing when you're in a hurry or you just don't want to do it or it's just going to work, you know? So
I definitely buy that. And the fact that it's 130,000 years ago, what we were talking about in the last segment with, you know, the evolution of tools or whatever. Well, 130,000 years ago, humans were, they were still modern humans, but they just weren't going to be making the things that they were making 10,000 years ago. They just weren't at that point, developmentally speaking, yet. So an expedient tool probably would, that would work for somebody that's 130,000 years old.
Yeah, totally.
So that part, I buy all of that.
Yeah.
So let's get to the cut marks.
Well, I mean, the cut marks, to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about those either. There's some people that think they look like they were created by humans, not on bones, and some people that don't.
Yeah.
Some people think they are, you know, could have been created by slicing motions to cut muscle off and stuff like that. And some people don't.
Yeah.
I mean, they're 130,000 year old fossilized bones. It's kind of hard to tell.
Okay.
So the real thing here is, what do we do with this information?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if we accept the possibility that humans were here 130,000 years ago, what do we do with that information? Right.
Yeah.
What does that actually tell us? And one of the things that Stephen Holland said in the podcast that I did with him a few years ago on this show was, we need to dig deeper. You know, we need more evidence. And and we've talked about that on this show before, and I've talked about it on other shows. A lot of times, just because of the expedient nature of cultural resource management, archaeology, which is how most things get excavated here in this country, in the United States anyway, the expedient nature of it says, well, you're going to dig as deep as your shovel will go if it's a shovel test, or you're going to go down to two sterile layers, or if you've had a geomorphology done and they say, you know, that'll only go down so far as well. They don't always go all the way down to bedrock, which is the lowest layer anywhere.
Yeah.
But bedrock could be dozens of meters below you, depending on where you're at, and nobody's going to go that deep, right? But if we want to really sample the area and find out what's going on, we need to start going that deep if these sorts of ages are at least theoretically possible.
Yeah, we just can't count out the fact that humans might have been here earlier than we originally thought.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like, it's okay to evolve our hypothesis. And now we need to adjust our research methods to meet the evolving nature of the hypothesis, right?
Right.
Nobody's saying that humans were actually here 100 or 130,000 years ago. You're not saying that. I'm not saying that. What we're saying is that there's a possibility for it. And we need to just move forward with our research methods that in a way that allows for that possibility. I think that's the main takeaway here.
And here's another thing too, is, you know, people are wondering, well, where's all the sites between, you know, Clovis or early pre-Clovis to this point in time? And again, we might just not be looking deep enough to find them. We might not be looking in the right places. But also there's another theoretical possibility is, people definitely came to the North America continent and South America, probably from North America and possibly some other ways, which we're not going to get into, but they definitely came to the North American continent. There's archaeological evidence of this through the ice-free corridor, and there's growing evidence for people coming down the coast of, you know, Alaska, Canada, down into the United States area now. So all of North America. But they would have done that when they could cross the Bering Land Bridge at the last glacial maximum, which is about the time that White Sands dates to and all that stuff. So when the glaciers were at their highest, they basically created these areas that don't exist when the glaciers don't exist. And the last time, well, at least one of the last times, there was also another glacial maximum was during the time of Cerruti. And who's to say when people were living in the Asian continents and African continents for millions of years, that some other groups of people didn't just chase the game and continue migrating over, and maybe they just didn't make it. Maybe they didn't make it when the Ice Age started again. They either didn't make it or we haven't found evidence of them. But why does there only have to be one migration into North America when there could have been Many, for that matter. I can't imagine the first people that came over here even barely made it. You know, why would they have?
I don't know, though.
It would have been hard.
The only thing that makes me skeptical is that, yes, most of North America would have been covered under a glacier during the maximum, but south of there was not.
Yeah.
So if they made it over here and they made it south of the glacier before any paths back to where they came from were closed, then it was so rich here in resources, in natural resources. There's no reason why they would have failed, but they could have. That still could have happened. But I just feel like the skeptics say, like, where are the other sites?
Yeah.
And it could be a not digging deep enough thing. That's definitely possible. Like, maybe there's sites sprinkled throughout the last 100,000 years if we dig in the right places. But I don't know. I would love to believe that that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to see more sites and more evidence showing it. But it's an interesting thing to theorize, for sure. That's sort of where I'm at with Cerruti, is that it's very interesting, and we need to do more research.
And I think that's exactly what Cerruti tells us.
Yeah.
Is that we need to broaden our research parameters and consider other things.
Yeah.
Right? We need to dig down deeper. We need to look in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
Look geologically at places like White Sands and say, all right, well, where are there other lake edges that are older than 6,000 to 9,000 years ago? Because we know where all those are.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the desert, you can actually see paleo lake edges up along the hillsides, if you know what you're looking for.
Right.
But and often, anytime you have a basin or some sort of valley or something like that in like the Great Basin of the United States in the Nevada area or Utah or anywhere else where it's really dry, there's still water down there.
Yeah.
And seasonally, after a big rain or something like that, you might have a little bit of a lake. But, you know, 9,000 years ago when the glaciers were melting, it was a big, deep lake.
Yeah, yeah,
and
totally.
Connected to other things. So,
yeah.
And there's a really good archaeological tradition of looking at those paleo lake edges and knowing exactly where the older sites are going to be, because you know where the edge of the lake was, you know, 8,000 years ago. You can just say, I want to dig in this time period, and you can just see it and dig there.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to go back further, and we need to figure out where those are. Now, it's really difficult to do this in places like Nevada and north of there, where it was actually covered by a glacier for 10,000 years or 20,000 years, because the glacier just destroys everything.
Yeah, that's
true. So there's that.
Yeah.
That's why we have to go to coastal sites in those areas, or see if the people that may have been living here at 25,000 plus years ago, when the glaciers started to come in, where were they pushed to? They were pushed to White Sands.
Yeah.
They were pushed to those areas, and that's where we need to look deeper and use all this evidence that we've been collecting for older sites and say, this could be a thing. I'm curious about Meadowcroft and how people could have been there at the time period they said they were, because I'm pretty sure there were glaciers
that was
pretty
glacier.
Close.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Obviously people would have thought about this, and it's not me blowing the whole thing up, but still.
Yeah, it's interesting because people had to work around the glaciers somehow. They had to. So, you know, we know we had the ice-free corridor. That was a path that people could take. That was, what, like 12,000 years ago or something like that? Or 16,000 years ago it opened up?
No, I mean, it started to thaw up around, you know, well, I guess 12 to 15,000 years ago.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have the coasts. And the coasts are what is most interesting to me because the coast would have been accessible no matter what the glacier activity was.
Yeah.
And we know that the sea level has risen and the shore is covered where people would have potentially been living in the ocean now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the ocean destroys things, but it can also preserve them too. But I would love to see more underwater archaeology going after what is potentially early sites if they have managed to survive. I don't really know what kind of preservation they're gonna have when you're just, I mean, maybe there might be some, but the ocean moves everything around. So who knows? But those early
roads things.
Yeah, it does. And like, even if there were lithic tools there, they would have been pushed around the ocean floor by now and probably not even recognizable as a stone tool at this point. But
totally.
Anyway, there's a lot of problems with it, obviously. But the coastal stuff is what is really interesting to me, because it seems the most feasible way for people to have gotten into the Americas around the glacier at any point, whenever they wanted to, they could have used the coastal route. So I don't know. There's just so much more research that needs to be done in everything, and we need to dig deeper. And that's what we were hoping to share with, you know, everybody by doing this 2-episode series.
Yeah. So what do you think? You know, what do you guys think out there? Are you a no freaking way kind of person? people weren't here prior to 14,000 years. And that's really the opinion I'm interested in, because if you're so adamant about it, I'm curious as to why.
Yeah.
Why the rigid stance? And I'm really speaking to archaeologists here, too, because there's a lot of archaeologists that are rigidly saying, no, that's not possible.
Yeah.
But I'm almost like, why isn't it possible that there were multiple migrations potentially and people died out and or are just in places where we don't know they were?
You know,
we didn't know those footprints have been sitting in the White Sands. White Sands is a national park.
Yeah.
And it's also a big, you know, military ground. And I think it was on the military side of it that they found all this stuff. And, you know, it's been literally under our feet for many, many years that we've been going out there as humans. And it's just like, how much other stuff is just right under our feet and we're just not looking in the right spot.
Yeah, totally. I mean, stuff like that is, you sometimes need the right day, the right light, the right wind, the right everything in order to see something like that. So I hope that we have better methods for uncovering this stuff in the future. Cause I think it's going to be really important to help figure out when people actually came to these continents. And I think it's a much bigger, longer, and more complicated story than we thought in the past. And that's great. Dive in. Like, keep excavating, keep digging, and keep answering those questions. But don't just like rigidly say no. Like, I mean, I want to know why you're saying that, like you said, but like open your mind a little bit.
All right. Well, we're going to go from the really old to the really new. We got to get to the track. So we're going to edit this episode probably at the Formula One track. It'll be super cool because we're going to a concert tonight. So
yeah, we got a couple hours in between to get some APN work done.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, thanks a lot for listening. And again, if you want to support us so we can buy an APN subscription to the National Geographic and some other things, arcpodnet.com/members, and check out any of the sponsors that you heard in the ad breaks. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening, and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.